So as I say, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 tonight. I did not have a large number of slides anyway, and the computer now says failure configuring Windows updates, reverting changes, do not turn off your computer. So whether it's trying or failing, I can't turn the computer off, but we'll live without our slides for this evening. I wanted to begin, though, by giving you a very little known fact, I suppose, but our Bibles, of course, everyone is well aware, did not come with chapter and verse headings to begin with. Those were introduced, apparently, by a guy named Stephen Langton in the very early 1200s. So we've had these chapter breaks and all for about 800 years. They were fairly well standardized, 800 years ago, and used that way ever since. And so we have gotten used to those breaks. But particularly tonight, I'd like to recommend that you make some sort of a mark in your Bible to link some material together, because I'm embarrassed to say myself that I got thrown off by a chapter heading last week, and I really wish that we had included chapter 8 with verses 16 and 17, the first verse of chapter 9. A chapter heading really would have been better if it began at 8:16 or else at 9:2, one way or the other. But those three verses, really belong together. And then I just got thrown off myself and forgot to work with that first verse. So let's start tonight with chapter 8 in Ecclesiastes, verse 16. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. Now you'll see that chapter 9, verse 1 begins with F-O-R. For I have taken all this to my heart and explain it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether, and they've supplied the words, it will be, but I think it really helps in this case. Man does not know whether love or hatred, pardon me, I've lost my place here, anything awaits him. So verse 1 again, I've taken all this to my heart and explained it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. So those three verses really ought to go together. Verse 1 of chapter 9 is a conclusion to verses 16 and 17. Really appreciate the work of Stephen Langton. Think he did yeoman's work, helped us a lot. Glad he did it. But in this particular case, there's that temptation, which I fell prey to last week, to divorce verse 1 from those verses 16 and 17, which all have to do with the simple fact that God reserves for himself, or else wisdom is just so high and difficult to attain that it's not possible. And I'm not sure if it's as if God has placed the screen and prevents us from knowing, or if it has to do only with it's difficulty. But you're not going to know, no matter how wise you are, all things. And most particularly, obviously, we cannot predict the future. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. So you may have a life in which people just extol your virtues and your wisdom and just think you're the greatest thing that there ever was. And so you'll be much beloved and famous for it. Or you might be despised and rejected of men. Quotation from Isaiah 53, referring to whom? Jesus himself. And his point is that whether you're righteous or wise doesn't make any difference. There is an inevitable fact of the matter that you cannot foretell the future. So, whenever you're in an election cycle or you're listening to anybody about anything, really, and they're saying, if this happens, well, then that will happen. Nobody knows that. It's impossible. We don't know it about ourselves. We don't know it personally. We don't know it about anybody else. And we don't know it about the nation. And we don't know it about the world. The work of God is such that He is preventing us, apparently, from knowing such things. That's His business and His decision, and I don't know why, but that appears to be the case. So, you don't know. Anything awaits you. And if you know that, then you can accept whatever comes, recognizing that it is not necessarily either to your credit what takes place, nor is it, you know, a critique. So, you can't claim that you knew what was coming, nor can you force what is coming. You just can't control what lies ahead. So, Solomon gave his heart to it in verse 16. He looked at the task which was done on the earth, and he realized that if you didn't sleep night and day, and you looked at all the work of God in verse 17, you will not discover that work. And then in 9, he took it all to heart. Righteous men, wise men, their deeds are in the hand of whom? The hand of God. Now, at this point tonight, I'm going to skip way ahead, but please link somehow verse 1 with verse 11. Now, it's clear to me that this is a fairly large section within the book of Ecclesiastes, that these ideas all go together, and we're going to look at them all in a minute. But verse 11 is so directly related here to this verse 1 that you want to link it somehow. So every time you come across 9:1, make sure you skip ahead in this chapter and read verse 11. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. So he gives you a whole bunch of examples right there. And before we get to the punchline, which you've already read and probably already know, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, how strong you are as a runner, as a racer, no matter how skillful and how well you prepared, you're not necessarily going to win the race. It does not matter how big your army is and how well prepared and well funded that it is and how guided, you know, its leadership, you may not win the war. And you might be the smartest guy there ever was, but that doesn't mean you'll ever have two nickels to rub together. Some of the wisest and smartest people that have ever lived couldn't make a living. They just absolutely couldn't pull it off. And then you have wealth to the discerning, which is very similar, nor favor to men of ability. You don't necessarily get respect, regardless of how well you've developed yourself in the sight of God and man. You're not necessarily going to be recognized for it. And then he tells you why. Why? Because of two things that he will add to the first and much bigger thing that we just read in verse 1. There is God, there is time, and there is chance. And in the face of these three, which one are you more powerful than? Absolutely none of them. God is working His plans, and very often we're not going to know because He doesn't want us to know, or it's just absolutely non-discoverable because it's higher than we have the capacity to know. And then there's time, and there's chance. The passage of time has enormous power over our lives. And then there's the roll of the dice. Chance. And this is a fascinating passage to me because God is in control, and we know that He is. He rules over the kings of men, according to Daniel chapter 9. And we understand in this Old Testament and knew very plain, God is managing these affairs. They're taking place the way they should. But beneath that management and underneath, you know, His administration, there is also somehow an element of chance. Things that just happen. Now, that's not to say He didn't know they were going to happen, but it is an element, it is a factor in the human existence and experience that God introduced into the program. There's a certain amount of randomness, apparently, that takes place. So sometimes you don't know if it'll be love or hatred. You can't foretell the future. You have no idea what's coming down the road right there. And that's because God is involved, verse 1. And sometimes you don't know what's going to happen out there in the future. And no matter how hard you work at it, how fast you are, how kind of a warrior you are, you know, et cetera, in the examples, you're not going to get what you want. And the reason why is both time and chance. These two influence all things. Now, as we've said a thousand times, I guess, already, you know, in the course of the book, does that mean you should give up in hopelessness, you know, say you can't win the rat race, and so, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life watching David Letterman reruns? That's all the ones I missed in 33 years. His last show tonight, in case you didn't know. Okay, so, a show I don't ever watch, by the way. That's the news. So, no! It's not to give up. It's not to quit. It's not to be discouraged or depressed. Always, brethren, this knowledge gives us confidence and power and ought to bring us some measure of peace and joy and contentment. I understand that. So, the next time some great cataclysm takes place in my life, I don't have to be moping and, you know, just lamenting my existence and saying over and over again, why me? Why my children? Why, you know, why? What's the answer to that question according to God, time, and chance? I don't know. And it's not necessarily my fault. Sometimes it is, and you want to try and discover, you know, do better. That's the pursuit of wisdom. But if it's not always my fault, then, and not necessarily God's punishing me either, we talked about that at some length, see, you can be content, you can be happy with your life. You don't have to carry this awful burden that somehow is a failure, you know, of some kind. That's just not the case. But the next time that something really great and grand and good takes place, and you're really on a roll, and people just think you're the greatest thing that ever happened, you know, better than sliced bread and all that, you know, and you're getting kind of pumped up and starting to feel like, you know, I'm pretty smart, or talented, or whatever it is, you know, what should you also be thinking? His point was, God, time, and chance have to do with those things, too. Now, if you've met, you know, successful people, or if you read articles by them, and they're available, you know, on the internet and thousands of books and all the rest of that. If you read the biographies, and since I'm a very young child, I don't know, I haven't done that case or what, but one of my favorite genres has always been biographies. And from the time I was very little and got my library card, I'd go check out biographies. I've just always enjoyed reading the story of people's lives. And now having been doing that for about 50-some-odd years, it's pretty apparent to me that frequently, if not universally, they will say to you, I sure was lucky. And they recognize it. It's not all under their control. And they can point at moments where they realize, this happened and my life went that way and it resulted in spectacular success. And at that moment, there was no way on earth that I could make a decision because I didn't know what was coming. And so there I was. It was just time and chance, and it went that way, and it was marvelous. But for a lot of people, what happened at that fork in the road? It went the other way. And there's not a thing in the world that they should be faulted or blamed for. That's just the way that it works out. So I find, you know, these verses, and especially when you put them together, very comforting, and I hope you do too. Go ahead, Carol.
I'm just wondering on an application in another direction. You know, time and chance, people spend their whole lives being told you have to be prepared for an earthquake or a hurricane. You know, every single thing you have to have insurance, you know, for death, for health. I mean, a person can have no money,
it'll drive you crazy and spend your entire inheritance, you know, trying to prepare for all these things. So you're seeing the picture, brethren. When Solomon presents this wisdom, it's very comforting, is what it should be. Now, it also means, though, that we still have to be very energetic in trying to do the best that we can. He has told us that wisdom is superior, and he's going to do that some more. He has told us that righteousness is superior, and he's going to tell us some more about that, too. He has given us tips and tricks on how to be more successful in life, not just in this book, but also in the book of Proverbs. You can increase your chances, brethren, if you buy a $1 lottery ticket. What are your chances of winning? And I don't know, it depends on lotteries and all that, but let's say it's 1 in a billion. Okay? Can you increase your chances? Sure, you can buy a second ticket. Now what are your chances?
2 in a billion.
Okay? But you doubled them. They are better. Okay? And then, if you bought 1 billion tickets, what would your chances be? You could probably win. But you will have spent money more by tickets than you win. So it's in that loss. But the point is, you can reduce risk and increase probability. You can have an impact on these things. And that is Solomon's point. So that you can, in Solomon's lottery year, still be contented and happy if you're a loser in life's lottery. You don't get the stuff. Okay? You can still grasp how it's okay. Or you can be a winner and still have what? Humility, too. Solomon's wisdom teaches us not to be discouraged, not to quit, not to get a bad attitude, but to learn the facts of the matter and then lead a happy and contented life. Now, first thing I suggested was you link verses 16 and 17 from chapter 8 and verse 1 of chapter 9. Then link together somehow verse 2 through 12. It will seem like when we get in the middle of this that it wanders a little bit, this theme, but that clearly these all belong together. And they're going to add another element for us in understanding the big program of how life works. So let's read these all together and then link them somehow, make a note in the side margin, starting with verse 2 down through verse 12. It is the same for all. There's one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, and for the unclean, for the man who offers a sacrifice and for the one who does not sacrifice. As the good man is, so is the sinner. As the swearer is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. There is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. For whoever is joined with all the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know they will die, but the dead do not know anything, nor have they any longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that is done under the sun. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life which he's given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life, and in your toil in which you've labored under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, verily, do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net
and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. Excuse me. I'm told it is one of these innumerable allergy seasons here, so I had some kind of bird in my throat there. Okay, so I think you can see that verses 2 through 12 are saying, you will die, and it will not matter one iota how you've lived your life from one end of the spectrum to the other. You will die just like everybody else. And you've only got one chance to be happy. So, during this little bit of time that you have, before you die and your entire involvement on planet Earth is gone, what should you do? You heard my refrain. Don't worry. Be happy. Be rejoicing in the things that you have that are good. We'll get the particulars there in just a little bit. And then, whatever your hand finds to do, the way of saying, whatever interests you, whatever it is that interests you personally, what should you do? Do it with all your might. Donna sometimes does this to me. I don't know if she does it, you know, just for fun or seeking information or what it is, you know. It just happened again yesterday. And suddenly she popped up. She says, do you know what a numismatist is, I think was the word. Okay. So raise your hand if you knew what a numismatist is. Carol? What is it?
He's a person who is able to memorize great lengths of numbers.
And if I can write all the word wrong, I thought it was a coin collector. What's a coin collector? It's a coin collector. Now, she gets 6 answers out of 7 correct, everybody. So look at her fast. So I told Doug, well, it's a coin collector. And then, so then I turned around and I said, what is a philatelist? Stamp collector. Okay. Well, great. Whether you're a numismatist or a philatelist, what should you do? Go crazy. Okay. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks about the things that you like. You may like the most obscure and crazy thing you know the world ever saw. But if it pleases you, then what? Go for it. Hey, if it feels good, do it! Yeah. Well, in the old days, we as Christians, when that slogan was going around, and I can't remember who was using it to sell something or other, you know, 25 years ago, you know, I was going around, and Christians rightly pointed out, well, no, you know, that's a terrible ethic if it feels good, do it. That's just to be, you know, entirely given over to carnality, and God has limits and all that, and he does, and that's right. Okay? However, within the boundaries of things, you know, that are moral and upright and acceptable, how should you live your life? Happy as you can. For as long as you can. Why? It's the only chance you got. You're going to die like everybody else. And so there's also a mistake that is made if you're always putting stuff off to the future. You're always worried about making sure that all the bases are covered, you know, and I've got to prepare for the kids and the grandkids, you know, for everybody else. And how many people have spent their lives worrying and collecting, you know, and depriving themselves, you know, work, you know, for concern about the future? A lot of people do that. What is Solomon saying? Don't be a fool. You need to think about the future to some extent. And at the same time, what? And if it feels good, we'll do it. Because what second chance are you ever going to get? You're just not. Later in the 12th chapter, he's going to especially make the point, you should do these things when? When you're young. So, you know, it's an oddity, I guess, you know, in life, our kids to be very responsible, you know, and we can plan for the future and all these things. And we as parents, we point out all the things that are frivolous and, you know, and we should work doing that, you know, and all this, you know, and even skateboarding and, you know, these thousand things that they get involved in. But what? Let's have to read for a little while that they can still ride skateboards. I remember riding skateboards. How many of you were skateboarders? It's great. Now, you want to get on one now? Oh, boy. I learned my lesson about skateboards, too, you know. There's a time for that. And then after a while, what does the wise woman say about skateboards? That's a young girl's game. Leave that for somebody else. So Solomon's advice is this. Knowing that you cannot control the future, knowing that you will die whether you're wise or fool, then be wise and carpe diem. Does that mean? Latin term? Seize the day. Okay? Enjoy your life. Now, he calls this an evil. Start back in verse 2. Same for all, one faith for the righteous, the wicked, the good, the clean, the unclean, the sacrificer, the swearer, and the opposites. But verse 3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. Here's one faith for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil, and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. And afterwards, they go to the dead. I know one of those verses where people say, why this guy is grim? Okay. He's just practical is all he is. Brethren, what is the world filled with? Evil and insanity. And it is evil. And it is insane. It's just insane. Okay? So now what? Solomon refers to it in verse 3 as an evil. And with all that going on, in the end, everybody's dead. Okay? But what about verse 4? Whoever's joined with all the living, there's hope. Surely a live dog's better than a dead lion. Okay? Yeah, I always love that comparison. Most people do. Why? Because the living know they'll die. The dead don't know anything, nor have they any longer reward. Their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, their zeal already perished. They'll no longer, you know, have a share. All that's done under the sun. Now, since that's the case, you get the good stuff in verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. Now, it was the second or third class. We went through the whole book. I had you circle or somehow mark every place where there's a reward in life. And there's more than one here in verses 7 through 10. So mark them. He gives you one side of the ledger or the scales. And, you know, we're all full of evil and insanity. It's crazy out there. But if you know that, then it won't bug you. Brethren, how crazy is it to think that because there is injustice in the world, I can fix it by looting a business and burning it down? That is both what?
Evil
and insane. Okay? And it's happening all over the world. It's happening, I guess, right now in Palmyra. Palmyra has got some of the best ruins from best preserved of the Roman Empire going back to 200 years B.C. What do we all hear in the news this afternoon? ISIS captured Palmyra. And what are they even doing? It's up in northeast of Damascus in Syria. What are they even doing to pass historical treasures in the museums? You know, all the antiquities, they're some of the most precious things known, you know, in human history. What have they done when they got to the museum? Trash the whole thing. You know, it's destroyed. And right now, they're just terrified that these guys are going to start blowing up some of the best preserved, you know, iconic buildings and columns and whatnot from 200 years B.C. Probably another thing will all be dust, you know, by dawn. Yeah, be worried about it. There's evil, and that's insanity. So what should you do? Verse 7.
go home, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart. God's already approved your works. It's all right. All that's going on out there. Going to lose sleep over it? Well, no. Anything you can do about it? What should you do to stop ISIS tonight from breaking down Roman columns that are 2,200 years old? What's that?
Say a prayer.
Say a prayer. That's exactly it. But that's, personally, you cannot do anything. Well, you could do this, though. You can go home and have a good dinner and drink your wine with a cheerful heart. God's already approved your works. You can't control them, but who can you control? Yourself. Now, 8. Let your clothes be white all the time. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Now, bear in mind, what they're saying is, do not go about in mourning. Let your clothes be white. And the oil reference, both of those would have to do the things that you would not be doing if you were in mourning over something. 9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he's given to you under the sun. This is your what? This is your reward. This is your reward. Now, it's bad in Syria, and we all know it. And it's bad in Afghanistan, and we all know it. It's bad in Pakistan and Iran and Iraq. And where else is it bad? It's bad a lot of places. And is there no evil or insanity in America? Well, there's that stuff all going on here, too. But currently, you know, we're not seeing the skies filled with, you know, munitions. So what? Enjoy your life. It's your reward, especially marriage, all the days of your fleeting life, which he's given to you under the sun. This is your reward, and in your toil in which you've labored. That is the satisfaction. Not necessarily a whole big pile of money and vacations in the Caribbean. Verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, verily, do it with all your might. For there's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where what? Where you're going. Okay? So, grab for all the gusto. That's another one of those slogans we had over how many years ago. I have no idea what they were selling. You know, but Solomon is promoting that idea. So long as you are a wise and righteous individual, you should be enjoying life to the hilt. Go out there and get as much of it, you know, as you can. Give all your strength to God, you know, wisely, reasonably. Now, let's back up for a minute, because there are a couple of verses, 3, that we need to put together that got split by 7, 8, 9. And we need to have just a very brief little doctrinal discussion right here. But if you will go back to verses 5 and 6, the living know they will die. The dead do not know what?
Anything.
Now, let's stop right there. If you take the phrase, the dead do not know anything, entirely out of the context, and you just focus on what the words say, then, isolated from all other thoughts in Scripture, will there be any afterlife? According to this verse, well, no. There would never be any consciousness. There's no knowledge. And so the living know they'll die, the dead don't know anything. If you tear it out of context, ignore all the Bible, and especially this immediate context, you would come to that conclusion. And then, if, missing all the additional data, you seize on that conclusion and you decide you're going to ride that horse right into the ground, then, you know, you would go on, they have no longer a reward. So what would that be saying about the afterlife? There isn't any, and there's no reward of any kind. And then, their memory is forgotten. Indeed, their love, their hate, and their zeal have already perished, and they will no longer have a share in all that's done under the sun. Now skip down to verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might, for there is what? No activity, planning, knowledge, or wisdom in Sheol. There is none of those things. Okay? Now, if you wanted to stake out a doctrinal corner for yourself in the religious world, and you wanted, you know, to teach a particular set of ideas about the afterlife, which is there's no such thing as one, no such thing as consciousness or any of these other things,
you could seize on these passages and say, there it is, Solomon has just told you everything you need to know about the afterlife, and that is, there is no consciousness, there is no knowledge, there is no wisdom, there is no planning, there is no activity. When you die, there is absolute, utter nothingness. Okay? Is that what the verses say on the surface? Certainly. What book are they in? Ecclesiastes. And what is Ecclesiastes dealing with? Life under the sun. And he has repeatedly and constantly, you know, throughout, been telling us that he's going to be focusing on life down here. So, when he says these things about the dead, and he encourages you to forgive God and insanity and evil, and be happy, and give yourself energetically to whatever it is you like to do in this life for the little while that you have, is he trying to give us a doctrinal dissertation about what happens after death? No! What is he doing? He is making a comparison with the fact that all those things you can do and have an impact while you're living on the earth. Then, after you die, none of those things exist anymore for you. Where? On earth. You can't impact the earth anymore. This is his overall point. So when he says, none of these things are taking place in Sheol where you're going, he's not trying to deny that there will ever be an afterlife, that there will never be any consciousness for anybody ever again. He's trying to say, once you go there, you cannot impact the earth. Your time is run, clock's out, you're done. Which is why he's telling us that in verses 7, 8, 9, and the first half of verse 10, what should we be doing with this little bit of time that we have? Enjoy it! Enjoy it! Not foolishly, not stupidly, but enjoy it. You know, best as you possibly can. This group of people, by the way, are called Jehovah's Witnesses. and I'm not quite sure, but I think Seventh-day Adventists teach, you know, a similar kind of a thing. And between the Pharisees and Sadducees, which one taught that same thing? The Sadducees taught that there was no life after death. There are no spirits, there's no resurrection. See, there's no life after death. And the Pharisees in Jesus' time, they believed in those things, but they had their own problems. You know, this is not a doctrinal dissertation about what happens after you die. It is a comparison to how important it is that you get busy about the life you have while you're living right here, because once it's over here, it's over here. No second chances. Okay? So, a little bit of a doctrinal deal there. Now, at this point, one more thing. Let's go to 12. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. Not only is death coming, but many times it comes very suddenly, very unexpectedly. It can come very young. Okay. So in all these verses, 2 through 12, there's some ideas, you know, but what's the point? A world full of evil and insanity, there's not anything you can do about it. You're never going to understand all of God's wisdom, which we got from the preceding verses, so how should you live your life now? Yes, you can be happy with whatever you have. Thank God for it, recognize the time and chance may take it all away, and go for all the vigorous enjoyment of life that you know how. And then, die happy. Okay? It's over then, because you can't, once you've entered Sheol, once you've passed out of this life, change a single thing here. All right, any comment or question then on that section? Okay, last few verses, 13 through 18. However, once again, let me, you know, gripe about Stephen Langton. Okay, Stephen Langton died in 1228. I don't know what years, probably. He was working on chapters and verses, you know, for us and helped us out a lot. But again, he did the same thing with chapter 10 that he did with chapter 9. So please somehow make a note that chapter 10 and verse 1 really should have been the last verse in chapter 9. So I'm going to start reading at verse 13. I'll finish with verse 1.
Also this I came to see as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. There was a small city with a few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor, wise man. What had he told us in 8:11? Scan 8:11 again. So there was found in this little city a poor guy who was wise. All his wisdom didn't make him any money. And, verse 15, he delivered the city by his wisdom. Somehow, he beat the big king. He won. That, you know, it worked, his idea. And then what happens at the end of verse 15? He was just as obscure when it was over as he was before. Nobody appreciated him for it. Well, that doesn't seem fair. So in 16, I said, wisdom is better than strength. Poor man's wisdom beat the big king, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The words of the wise, heard in quietness, are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. Oh, that's just awful, isn't it? He's got several little aspects of this thing. And yes, apparently the city paid some attention. They heeded the man's words on this one occasion. And he saved the whole city. And then no parade. Nobody pays any attention. And apparently, the point of the subsequent verse, as time goes on, when he had other advice, what did they do with it? Okay, no attention. Everything just goes back to same old, same old. So, is wisdom and righteousness still something you should be pursuing? Look at 18. Sure, wisdom's better than weapons of war. But what? Now, brother, this is just like the evil and the insanity. And I see the frustration, and I hear it from you personally all the time. And I heard it from every other Christian I've ever known all the years, you know, that I've been a Christian. The frustration, you know, that it just doesn't seem like anybody cares. It just doesn't seem like anybody's interested. You know, even our own brethren. So we don't have maybe a third of the congregation here tonight. Does that frustrate you? I know it's a concern for the elders. I know it's a concern for me. You know, I wish everybody was here every time we meet. I wish we could meet 5 days a week and everybody would be here. But is it ever going to be that way? No! Because it's the nature of things that even when you meet a wise person and you know one personally and they did something that impressed you and it worked, could have saved the whole city. How enduring is that respect in the natural human being? It's just smoke in the wind. And that's awful. Okay? And here's the problem. Looking now at verse 1 of chapter 10. It's just like you have a very valuable commodity, something that's worth a whole lot, you got a whole lot of it, and one fly falls down into the perfume. Now what? The whole thing is ruined. So, how much foolishness? A little is weightier than what? Wisdom and honor. Okay? Is that right? You say, well, no, it's not right. Because it's so. Yes. Now, if you find that really frustrating, I know I do. Okay?
God feels about it when he looks down at a world where the way is straight and narrow and few there are who find it. That he made it. And according to 3:11, set eternity in their hearts so they would seek after him. And promises that if you ask and seek and knock, you cannot fail. But to find the wisdom, the knowledge of God, he'll give you all good things if you just seek for it. And now he looks down at the world, and what? Who cares? Who's interested? Very, very few. Okay? And then in the gospel, sower goes out to sow. How many soils does seed get in? Four different kinds. How many of them produce well? One out of four. 25%. Wisdom, does it acquire respect, honor?
Never has, brethren, and it never will. That's the way that it works. So, all this frustration that we have about this, and constantly bugging us and irritating us and upsetting us, and we want to gripe about it and complain about it, and we talk to each other about how unhappy we are, you know, about all these things, is what? That's foolish. And it's counterproductive. And you should be going, well, duh. And then what? Don't worry. Be happy. That's the way it is. It's the most wonderful book. So, is there going to be evil out there in the world?
Yes.
What about insanity?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're going to set yourself to be on the straight and narrow path. And who's going to respect you for it? To almost nobody. What honor are you going to get for it? To almost none. So, not worth it? What does he say in the last verse of chapter 9? Should have been the next to the last verse. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, brethren. It means that it's powerful. But one sinner destroys much good. It has always been that way, and it always will. Now, does that mean that God is not in control? No. If Josephus' account is correct, and with Josephus we learn a lot, he's profoundly helpful, but, you know, it's kind of verifiable, he's sometimes prone to exaggeration, and there are stories that we're really not quite sure about. But if in this case, you know, it's just a straight-up historical fact, in 70 A.D., September it was, in Jerusalem, Titus Vespasian, the general whose dad had gone back home to become emperor of the Roman Empire, gave explicit orders that that temple was not to be harmed. But a soldier got carried away, according to Josephus, and he threw a flaming torch through a window. One guy. And what happened out of sight on the other side? A conflagration that would then grow until what fell? This temple that took 46 years to build. So glorious, so beautiful, so amazing, was burnt up and then dismantled by the Romans. Another story we get is that the gold, you know, melted and went down in the cracks and all this dumb stuff, you know, so they tore it up to get at it. And I don't know if that's so, because Titus gave the order to just take it down anyway. But he didn't want it done initially. Now it had been destroyed and it fulfills Jesus' prophecy in Matthew 24. Not one stone was left on another. How did it work out that not one stone was left upon another? A single soldier got carried away to eternity. Okay. One guy who disobeyed orders. And what happened? You know, disaster. And when the next time you see a riot, is the whole city evil? No. What happens in the riots? People get all excited, you know, and they get all worked up and all that, but, you know, what does it take to get a building looted or burned to the ground? All it takes is one fly in the ointment, doesn't it? And then it's loose. It's like water, you know,
through your fingers when Solomon was talking about
be careful how you use your words in the book of Proverbs. So, in verse 16, we'll wrap this up in 16. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. So if you're feeling weak and inconsequential, you know, and you don't amount to much, and you don't get much respect, and you're not accomplishing anything, all that, just remember this. Being wise is the best thing. But the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. So when you are disrespected, that's no reason to give up the quest. It's no reason also to sit down and be all discouraged and upset. So you should have expected that. Of course. And then, the words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools.
Why is 17 there? To say, you did right to be here tonight. Now this might be the worst class I ever taught. Somewhere in these years, you know, there's going to be that. And then there's going to be the next and the worst class I ever taught, the third and the worst class I ever taught. And then there'll be half the classes that are substandard. And the story of my life, when it's all done, is that for all my effort, it falls in the whole spectrum like that. So, should you come or not? The pursuit of wisdom is what? The great treasure. The most important thing. And it will not look like it pays off. So what? The acquisition, wisdom, righteousness, purity, these things, this, the man who knew, explained, is the most important thing. So, in 18, it's better than the weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good.
Now, brethren, I've known a few preachers in my lifetime. I've been called by other preachers to go meet with them and their elders to try to rescue congregations that were in trouble. Congregations that no longer exist because we failed. Why? They had some one rebellious, disgruntled troublemaker who was just never happy and always yapping and gossiping and creating problems, you know, and congregations that had existed for decades, brethren, can fall all to pieces in a matter of months and split up and vanish. And you say, well, it's the elder's fault, was it? Not necessarily. What do you mean? To destroy everything that had been on decades, centuries, millenniums for that matter. What does it all take? One sinner. You get flying on it. And can you control it? Can you necessarily stop it? What I'm trying to say is, can you ensure that you can prevent that? No! So, if this is what happens to this congregation, suppose we turn the corner now. Suppose we start dwindling away, and a couple of years from now, there's no more Cobra Grove Church. How should we feel about this? Well, it'd be disappointing, it'd be heartbreaking, it'd be awful, you know, for the survivors who care. And what else? Maybe the best thing, ran its course, God knows what he's doing, and so everything fell apart. What are you going to do about it? Be faithful until death. Because we do not serve God because of the physical reward that he gives us now. And we do not serve God because we're going to get some kind of big credit for it in this life. We serve God without any reference, brethren, to what happens under the sun. We serve God because of eternity, because of a heaven where there is no need for that orb to be in the sky. There is no sky any longer. This is the most wonderfully encouraging book, I suppose, in the Old Testament. It says, look, here is the key to happiness in this life. Be wise. Enjoy it best you can, and then die like a dog. Okay? Die like a dog, but die happy.
Happy?
One more.
Faithful.
You die happy and faithful. Okay? Comment or question? Go down and do likewise.